In terms of the upcoming other legal holidays, we have the opportunity on December 25th to hear from Rav Daniel Stein, and then on January 1st from Rav Aryeh Leibowitz. So mark your calendars accordingly, and we can show our appreciation on days that are on Thanksgiving as well. Good morning, we have the opportunity to hear a very, very special friend on a personal level, but a very special Talmid Chacham. Rav Shai Schechter has built a tremendous name for himself because of simply being who he is, somebody who has a love and a passion for Torah, and in parallel to that, a tremendous Ahavat Yisrael and a caring for individuals. And he's, you know, Baruch Hashem has taken the lessons that he's learned from his father and from other Talmidei Chachamim that he has surrounded himself with and be able to create for himself a model in which he can inspire many, many Jews. The member of the illustrious rabbinic team at the Young Israel of Vermeer, and it's a tremendous cover for us to be able to close this morning. Rav Shai Schechter, Kavod. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Rabbi Dad. My wife called me as I was pulling up here, and she said, I think you made it to TNAC faster than it took me to get the kids to and from school this morning. So I thank you for having me on a legal holiday when you arranged for a very special Kritos HaDerech, and I thank all of you for coming this morning. It's always the greatest privilege in the world is to teach Torah and to share the words of Torah Hashem with those who are mevakshei Torah Hashem, with those who want to hear the incredible words of Torah. As we know, this morning is Rosh Chodesh Kislev, so we're finishing up the month of Mar Cheshvan, and Kislev, we start to get excited once again, because now we have new mitzvahs to focus on. Now we have the mitzvahs of Hanukkah and all that goes along with it, and all the celebration, and what I'd like to focus on this morning is a mitzvah that potentially gets ignored in our generation because it's not really so applicable. But there are incredibly important lessons that we can take from this mitzvah. And by that I refer to the mitzvah of Bikurim. Obviously this morning we're talking about Thanksgiving, because it is Thanksgiving. Bikurim is our time in the Jewish experience when we have the opportunity to give our Thanksgiving. When a farmer comes and brings his first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Kohen, and offers them in Yerushalayim. And as we know, Bikurim is not something that is only done at a particular part of the year. The Mishnah writes that the final time that one is able to bring the Bikurim is all the way up until Hanukkah. So we're still in the season of Bikurim, if you will, and Mar Cheshvan that we're just finishing now, it's still an opportunity to focus on that after the excitement of the Yom Tovim are over. One is still able to make up for that mitzvah of Bikurim, and that's what I'd like to focus on. Let us begin with a Mishnah in Meseches Bikurim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel. So what happens is, you have a farmer who has a lot of produce that's growing, and he has the opportunity and the obligation to bring those fruits up to Yerushalayim, and those are what we refer to as the Bikurim. So he makes his way up, writes the Mishnah, Hashor Olech Lefneim. There was a whole parade, a whole procession that would travel up to Yerushalayim. Is that like part of the effect of the shir? So, right now, Ashar Holeh Lefneim, this has never happened. Ashar Holeh Lefneim, so they would have a whole procession that was traveling all the way up to Yerushalayim. So imagine, I'm a farmer out in the Negev, and now I have to bring my fruits up to Yerushalayim, and it could be there are a lot of farmers that go together, so they would all travel. And Hashor Holech Lefneim means they would have a horse or an ox that would run in front of them, the Karna Mitsupos Zav, and they would coat the horns of that animal with gold, the Atara Shalzayis Barosho, and then they would put a big band of flowers on the head of this animal, HaChalil Makel Lefneim, they had a flute and band and drums that was playing music, Avshemagim Karav Yerushalayim. So this was a beautiful scene, that you would have these farmers traveling up to Yerushalayim with a big parade going on. Now, Higiu Karav Yerushalayim, they finally make their way up to Yerushalayim and remind ourselves that in the days of the Beit HaMikdash, when there was no transportation like we have today, it could have potentially taken a farmer, the Gemara says. It could have taken somebody 2 weeks to get all the way from his home to the Beit HaMikdash and 2 weeks back. So this was a very difficult journey. The Gemara says that the reason why we wait in Eretz Yisrael to begin saying the same Talamata Lebracha until Zion Cheshvan is because we want to make sure that the last person who came up for Aliyah L'Regel on Sukkot has enough time to get home, which is 2 weeks. So the assumption is our Jews who live in Israel, who it takes them 2 weeks to travel. By the way, when we talk about that, it seems that there was an assumption in the days of the Gemara that once we start saying the same Talamata, it's actually going to rain. Like they really believed in the power of Tfilah. It's really going to happen. That's what the Gemara seems to say, and therefore the Gemara tells us we cannot say the same Talamata while people are still traveling because of course it's going to rain. So how would we do that? That would be very unfair to them. Anyway, so we know you have a farmer who travels 2 weeks there, potentially 2 weeks back, and now he finally makes it to Yerushalayim. As they were coming closer, Shalchu Lifneihem, they have a number of couriers who run into Yerushalayim ahead of the farmer, and Hafachos Hasganim Ha'Gizbarim Yotzim Mikrasim. You have all these deputies, all these representatives from Yerushalayim would go out of the city to greet and to usher in all of these farmers who had come. Now here's the troubling sentence, and we'll get back to this in a few minutes. L'fikavod Hanichnasim Ha'yu Yotzim. What does that mean? It means that based on how important you are, based on how distinguished or how celebrated a farmer was, that is the kind of reception that they got. It was commensurate with your honor. So if you were a very well-known farmer and everybody spoke about you and everybody celebrated you, then you had a big crowd of people who came out of Yerushalayim to greet you. And if not, if you were just a simple farmer, then you got a smaller reception. That's what the Mishnah writes. V'chal bali umnis shebi Yerushalayim, all of the shopkeepers, all of the vendors, all the merchants there, omdim l'fneihem v'shalim v'shlomam, they would have beautiful conversations. So now, number one, the Gemara wants to know both in Maseches Kiddushin as well as Maseches Chulin Daf Nadalet, why is it that everybody has to stand up when these farmers enter Yerushalayim? What are we standing up for? Why are we all going out of town? Why are we leaving Yerushalayim to help them come in? Let them go do their mitzvah. Why is it our obligation to go out of our way? Why do I have to close my shop just because a farmer is coming to Yerushalayim? And Rashi explains, based on the Gemara, the reason is because Kedei Shalot Tehei Machshivan Liyasadava, which means this is a very difficult job, and we need to make sure that we encourage a farmer to do it again. If a farmer is going to come to Yerushalayim, take off a month of work potentially to do his mitzvah, what's going to make him want to do it again next year? Well, we're all human beings. Everybody likes a little bit of recognition. Everybody appreciates a little bit of kavod, whether it's right or it's wrong. This is the way we are. And therefore, in order to encourage people to be involved in this mitzvah once again in the future, we go out of our way to give them kavod. We go out of our way to give them respect. And that is an important idea in halacha that is not only relevant to the mitzvah of Bikurim, but it's relevant to a number of other areas, as we will see. Number one. The Gemara says in the Sefer Yuma in the last parak, Minayin l'pikuach nefesh shadocha es ha-Shabbos. How do we know that when somebody's life is in jeopardy on Shabbos, how do we know that we violate the Shabbos in order to save a life? That's a very strange question, because the Gemara never asked that about any other mitzvah. So why do we have an assumption that Shabbos will be pushed aside because somebody's life is in danger? And the Mefarshim on the Gemara say, it seems the Gemara is assuming that, of course, we're going to save a life and violate Shabbat. The question is, how do we know it? Well, who said it's true in the first place? But anyway, the Gemara makes that assumption, and the Gemara goes through a whole slew of possibilities on how we learn that Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbat, and Pikuach Nefesh is the overarching principle that trumps everything else, basically. And the Gemara comes to the conclusion because the Torah says, V'chai Bahem, which means that God expects us to live by the Torah. God doesn't expect us to sacrifice ourselves for the sake of the Torah. And therefore, the Gemara says, if we have a conflict between Shabbos and somebody's life, obviously we will be mechal Shabbos. Not only when somebody's life is certainly in danger, but even when you have what we refer to as a suffix pikuach nefesh. Even if I don't know whether or not this is life-threatening, I err on the side of caution, and I do what has to be done. That is the halakha. That is what's expected of us. So much so that the Shulchan Aruch writes, what if I happen to have no medical background? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nurse. I know nothing about medicine. And I see on Shabbos that there's a child who falls off a swing and he's gushing blood out of his head. And I'm nervous. And I put the child quickly into the car and I rush to the hospital. And I get there and the doctor says, hey, there was really no reason to come in. He could have just put a few gloves on, a Band-Aid. He would stop bleeding. Look, I didn't know that. I thought that I was saving the kid's life. And it turns out that I wasn't. It turns out that I really did not have to drive to the hospital to do that. Says the Shulchan Aruch, if that is the case, if that happened, you are not a Machal Shabbos, because in your estimation, you understood that you were involved in life-saving activities. And therefore, you have nothing to feel sorry about. You were doing what you felt was the right thing to do, and that is the right thing to do. So much so that the Shulchan Aruch writes, if somebody has a case of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, and instead of rushing to the hospital, they run to the rabbi's house first to ask, should we be going to the hospital or not? Says the Shulchan Aruch, quoting a Yerushalmi, Hashoel Hareza Shofet Damin. If you take time to go ask a Shaila before going to the hospital on Shabbat, you are potentially a Shofet Damin because minutes and seconds count, and you never know what will happen if you delay. And number two, even more surprising, is Hanishal Hareza Meguna. The rabbi who was asked also is problematic. So my father always told me the reason why is because if a rabbi is a leader of a community and he has not properly informed them of the protocols for what one should do when there's an emergency on Shabbos, it means you're an ineffective rabbi. It means you're not doing your job properly. And that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. The claim here is not only against the person who asked, the claim is also against the person who is being asked. Hanishal HaReza Meguna means I didn't do my job properly enough to make sure that everybody knows clearly when there's an emergency on Shabbos, we jump and we run and we do what has to be done. And the Rambam even says that when Chilul Shabbos needs to be done for the sake of a cholera, the Rambam says it should be done on Yedei HaGadolim. When you read the Gemara, it seems the Gemara is contrasting a katan, a young child, versus a gadol. And the Gemara is saying, don't go running around looking for a young child to do a melacha for you. Do it yourself. The Rambam says, no, that's not what it means. The Rambam says, Ayidei HaGadolah means by the leaders of the community. When Chilul Shabbos needs to be done, make sure the leader of the community is at the forefront. And I never fully appreciated that Rambam until I had a situation myself. Every summer I have a great privilege to go to Camp Simcha for 2 weeks. And I serve as the camp rabbi there for 2 weeks. Now, one Shabbos, there was a terrible emergency on Shabbos. And everybody was frozen. And nobody knew what to do. And we were all discussing. I said, get in the car. We need to go. And everybody was scared. It was a particular emergency. And I realized nobody's moving, so I got in the front seat. And it wasn't until I got in the car that suddenly everybody else who was supposed to get in got in and did the same. And I realized that Rambam is correct. It has to be Nasa Sayyidei HaGadolim. A person has to understand if others are looking up to you, if others are taking your example, you need to set the example. You cannot just deflect and send other people to do it, you need to do it yourself. I mention this because when we talk about the institution of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, it is a complicated story, but it's become even more complicated because we have, at least in our community, here you don't have Hatzalah, correct? Here, my understanding is many of the religious Jews volunteer for the municipality who has their own system. But say, for example, I would imagine it's very much the same. Or probably when you're working with the local municipality, there are certain regulations that you need to follow regardless. But let's say the institution of Hatzalah. That is in many, many different communities. So it was a big question. And a Hatzalah member is called on Shabbos. He goes on a call. Let's say he works all week long. He was traveling all week. Finally, he gets to sit down with his family Friday night. He makes kiddush. He washes. Gets a call. Runs out of the house. And he ends up in the ER with somebody. What allows him to come home? What allows him to come home? So this is a big question. So Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach discuss the merits of whether or not this Hatzalah member would be allowed to come home. Now, number one, there's an argument to be made that if he's going to be stuck in the hospital the rest of Shabbos, maybe somebody's going to lose out from his services. It could be we don't have enough Hatzela members in the neighborhood, and one man down means one less man to be available, or woman, to be available to help somebody in the neighborhood who might need their help or assistance. Leaving that aside, let's say we're inundated with medical professionals, we have no lack of members of our neighborhood who are able to help. Why would this person be allowed to come back? And this is a big shaila. Is the person actually allowed to come back or not? And Rav Moshe and Shlomo Zalman disagree about a particular sugya Maseches Beitza. He was suffering from Chivatam. But either way, Rav Herzog has in one of his tshuvas an additional point to consider. And that is, he says, we need, based on this gemara that we mentioned, for those who remember where we started, we need to make sure Kedei Shalotei Mashila Miyasid Labo. We need to encourage people as much as we can to modify their behavior that it should be a certain type, the way we want it to be. And therefore, that is why the Gemara says we go out of our way to stand up for the farmers, because we want to encourage that kind of behavior, that they should go out of their way, be recognized, come to Yerushalayim, understand that we're proud of you. And here as well, Rav Herzog, we need to take that into consideration. That if we're not going to do something to encourage a Hatzalah member to go on a call next week, and we're going to tell him he has to sit in the ER the rest of Shabbos and wait there until Shabbos is over, he will never go on a call again. And therefore, Rav Herzog, we need to take that into serious consideration. Sometimes we need to do certain things, even though not exactly what we're comfortable with, but we need to do it in order to encourage people to modify a certain behavior or for them to be encouraged to do this again in the future. I'll give you another example. When we talk about the laws of tzedakah, the Ramah is pretty clear about how tzedakah is supposed to be given. So let's look at the Ramah together in number 8. Says the Ramah, I don't know if you're having a building campaign here or not, but by us in Woodmere, we're in the midst of a building campaign. And when that happens, you have some people, obviously, who want a building, many people who do not want a building, but you have some individuals who step up and say, you know, I'd like to dedicate this part of the building, I want to give that way, or I want to dedicate this classroom or that level. And we have all kinds of dedication opportunities. Well, says the Ramah, Lo yispar adam bistaka shehunose. Do not flaunt the charity that you give. Do not advertise and broadcast that to the world. V'im yispar, and if one does, if they look for recognition, Lo dai she'enem akadoskar, not only do you lose out for the tzedakah that you have given, afilu ma'anishin oso alem. Wow, so the Ramah in very strong words here is actually quoting a tshuva from the Rashba, and he's very extreme in his position, that nobody is allowed to flaunt the tzedakah that they give. So I ask you, you go into the hallway here, I'm sure that along the way you will find people's names. So are we all in violation of this Ramah? I got an email a number of years ago from somebody who lives in a different country, and he said that he listens to the shiurim online, and he had a shiloh. I said, okay. But his shiloh was that he is a multi-millionaire. He gives millions and millions of dollars to tzedakah every year. But he said he never wanted anybody in his community to know that he was the one behind. So he set up a whole system where he gives all of his money to somebody else, and that person gives all the charity to all the causes that he feels are worthy. Nobody in the neighborhood knows. What is a shaila? He said, now he has a daughter who's starting to date. And he said, every member of my community thinks I'm a miser. Because every time they come to ask me to participate in anything, I never seem to come through. Now, why it never dawned on anyone, why you come and ask this person for money, and a month later there's a $1 million check that nobody knows where it came from. I don't know, nobody has ever put it together. But he said, everybody in the neighborhood thinks that I'm the cheapest, stingiest, awful, evil person out there. And he wanted to know. I don't like to flaunt the charity that I'm involved in. I don't want people to know what I did. It's between me and God. But now it's hurting my children. And he wanted to know, what are the protocols now? It's not just between me and God. Now it's between me, God, and my family. And that is unfair. That's an amazing shout. That's a very impressive question, a very impressive perspective that somebody has, and it's very much in line with what the Ramah writes here. And as we know, this generally is not something that we follow. And the Magen Avraham even quotes a story from the Sefer Hasidim where he says there was a town that wanted to build a shul, and everybody wanted to contribute equally to partner in building this shul, and somebody stood up and said, no, all or none, I want the shul to have my name on it, nobody else is allowed to be involved, And if you take my contribution and put my name on it, fine. If not, I'm out. And the Magen Avraham quotes from the Sefer Hasidim that the reason why this man wanted to do it is because he said that he wants his children and his grandchildren to remember what a special grandfather they had, what a charitable individual he was. And the Magen Avraham writes, the Kala Zahra. Astounding words. The Kala Zahra. He didn't have grandchildren to appreciate that. Because of the perspective, because of the attitude that he had. And how do we explain this? Says the Rama. Mikoma, and look in the next line. Misha Magdish Dabar Litzdaka. Mutalo Sheyichtav Shmo Alav Sheyiyah Alav Zikaron Viroin Lassos Kane. Says the Rama. Although the golden standard is that people should not flaunt, people should not advertise the charity endeavors that they're involved in. However, says the Rama, Roy Lazoskin, in our generation, he says, we all know that everybody can use a little bit of recognition. And we all know that if we recognize somebody for doing something positive, it will encourage others to do it, and it will encourage that person to do it again as well. And therefore, the Rama says, based on this principle, we want to make sure that we encourage people to do things that are difficult for them to do. We go out of our way. And even though it's not something we're totally comfortable with, we do it because we need to do it. And it's important that we do it. Lahavdil alfei havdalos. We know that in some communities, they have summer camps that are named after suicide bombers. And there's a reason for that. They want to encourage a certain kind of behavior. And they want to celebrate and they want to recognize certain individuals in the community in order that others should learn from that kind of behavior. And this is the same thing, again, lahavdil, it's not at all the same, but it's the same kind of idea. Have we also, says the Rama, understand that recognition is important. And that people learn something from the message that we give of who we choose to recognize, how we choose to recognize them, and what they are being recognized for. And therefore, the Rama says, in our generation, Rali Lasos came. So that is point number one from our discussion. Point number two, the Gemara says, a reason. Why do we stand up when these farmers enter into Yerushalayim? Very good question. Says the Gemara, because Chaviva Mitzvah B'Shaita. Because we are celebrating the fact that you are now engaged in the performance of a mitzvah. You ever go to a wedding? Our shul happened to have two weddings every night of the week this past week. So, you go to a wedding, and you'll notice by the chuppah that everybody stands up in the chasen or kala and march down the aisle. Do you ever think that that's strange? Non-Jews do it too? Ah, so then I have no explanation. Interesting. Interesting. So, if you're just curious, so you want to see the bride, you want to see the groom, you want to watch what's going on. But I would imagine there's something more behind it, and it always troubled me. You stand up for a chasen and kala. How old are most people who get married in our generation? I mean, not most, but how much have they accomplished already by the time they're walking down the aisle? What are we standing up for them? What have they done? And why do we... What? So some think the reason is because chasen dama lamela. That is probably incorrect because he's not yet a chasen. Chasen dama lamela means after he gets married, he's dama lamela. For Paul once said, a chasen came to me and said, how long do we say chasen dama lamela? How long does my status of kingship last? And he said, as long as you treat your wife like a queen. There it came all that time.
It's an important message.
So chasen dama lamela would be a good answer, other than the fact that he's not yet a chasen. My father once told me that, I think Rav Breuer or Rav Schwab, one of the Rabbanim Breuer said, that he didn't like to call an engaged couple, the way we refer to engaged couples today is not what the Gemara referred to as in Arusa. That's not the same. We don't really get engaged today. It's just ceremonial. So when a couple gets engaged today, the minute was that they didn't call them a chasen and kala. And that was because you are not a chasen, you are not a kala. Again, we're not talking negatively about them, but he was concerned that once we start calling them chasen and kala, they think they have a right to hug each other, to kiss each other, to touch each other. And meanwhile, you're not related yet. You're not married. You're not related. There is no heter at all. You're a boy. You're a girl. You're not connected in any way. And therefore, we maybe should be careful about calling them a chasen and kala because it might lead to people not being careful about certain things that they should. So anyway, Why is it that we stand up? Or say, for example, you ever attend Rahmana Litzlan, a funeral, and they make an announcement, all rise. Why are we rising? I think about it. I never stood up for this person when they were alive. Very often you see people who come to a funeral who really were not on such good terms with the person who passed away, really did not show them any respect at all while they were alive. And now by the funeral they feel bad, so they show up. Why are they standing up? What are we standing up for?
Because who they are called.
So the answer is, right, the Bartanura, we're not standing up for the person who passed away. We're not standing up for the Chassan or the Kala who are marching down the aisle because of their accomplishments. They don't have so many accomplishments. They're pretty young. They haven't done so much in their lives. You go to a Bris Mila, everybody stands up. This child has not done a thing yet. This is the first mitzvah he's about to do, and he's not even doing it himself. It's being done to him. Why do we stand up for the child? The answer is we don't. We stand up by a levaya, not for the mace. We stand up for the nosei hamita, for the chever kadisha who are involved in the tremendous mitzvah of chesed shalemus. We stand up by a wedding because the chasam and kala are about to be engaged in a very important mitzvah, and we stand up out of respect to the mitzvah that they are doing. So the Navi Yehuda, I believe, asked the question that that's true, that we're supposed to stand up every time someone is engaged in a mitzvah. I would be standing all day long. I come to shul and somebody's davening next to me, I have to stand up because he's davening. I have to stand up because he's putting on his talis tefillin. I have to stand up because a woman is running Shabbos candles. I'm never going to sit down my whole life. So there has to be some kind of guideline, but the general principle is that we stand up out of respect to somebody who is doing a mitzvah, and that is exactly what the Mishnah teaches us here. The reason why we stand up for the farmer who raises the Purim is because we want to show a level of respect for the mitzvah that he is involved in. Let us go back to that original line in our Mishnah when we spoke about what kind of reception people get when they come to Yerushalayim. So the Mishnah says a very curious statement. To measure it with the amount of prestige that you had, with how honorable a man or woman you were, that is the kind of reception you got when you came to Yerushalayim. Now the Yerushalmi asks, is that really the case? Ask the Yerushalmi, I didn't put it on here, I forgot. Do we believe that there is a more prominent, a more important and distinguished member of the Jewish people over somebody else? Is that really the way our community works? The answer is yes, unfortunately. It does work that way, but it's not supposed to. So the Yerushalmi asks, V'chiyesh katan v'gadol v'yisrael? Really, depending on how important you are, on how rich you are, on how famous you are, that's what kind of reception we give you when you come to Yerushalayim? Ask the Yerushalmi. Don't we assume that every Jew who is involved in the performance of a mitzvah is equal? Don't we assume that everybody is equally beloved in the eyes of God for performing his mitzvah? So much so that the Gemara says in the Sefer Kiddushin Daf Ayin, the Gemara writes, "Parnes kiven shenismana al hatzibur asur lo sheyasa malacha b'fnei shlosha." Says the Gemara, if you have a community leader and they represent something bigger than themselves, I'm not just representing myself. A community leader represents their community. So says the Gemara, you have to have a certain kind of behavior that is respectable to the community, because you're not just yourself anymore. And therefore the Gemara says, "Asur lo sheyasa malacha b'fnei shlosha." Your car breaks down right in the middle of the highway. Maybe it's inappropriate for you to be laying on the ground underneath the car on 16 and having your hands all dirty. Everybody who passes is going to say, "Really, that's the governor, that's the mayor, that's the rabbi." Not respectable, not because of you, but because of what you represent. So the Gemara says you're not allowed to be involved in certain activities because it's beneath the dignity of all those people that you are a representative of. However, the Gemara says, let's say I buy a new house. And one of the mitzvahs that I have when I buy a house is to build a makkah. I have to build a fence around a roof that nobody should get hurt. So the Gemara says, Yachal who live in this makkah. Absolutely. Build your own fence. Build your own roof. Why not? What are you, in Paris? You're going to stand out there with your hammer and your nails and build a fence around the roof? You're doing God's mitzvah. Nothing to be ashamed of. That's not beneath you. That is exactly what you should be proud of. We don't have certain levels of people who, if beyond them to be involved in a mitzvah, it's not beyond anyone. It's not beneath anybody. God asks all of us equally to perform mitzvahs. God gives us equal opportunity. The Chavos Yair, one of the great
German poskim in the 17th century. He writes, quote in the Mishnah Berurah, he writes to Shiloh that there was a great Talmud Chacham in his town who was invited to a wedding. He came to the wedding and somebody said, you know, the Chassan and Kala are aware that you also know how to play the flute or the violin, whatever it may have been. Maybe you would be Mesameach Chassan and Kala and play music for them as well. And the Talmud Chacham said, you know, usually when a Talmud Chacham comes to a wedding, he doesn't also serve as the band. This is not normal. But at the same time, he said, if it's going to give the Chassan and Kala a certain level of simcha, maybe I should do it. And he wasn't sure. They sent a shadow to the Chavos Yair and he discusses it. Is it beneath me to do something that is going to be Mesameach Chassan and Kala? Normally I wouldn't stand in the middle of the street and play violin. Not my job. But if it's something that's going to make the Chassan and Kala happy, maybe I should. So there's somebody in Eretz Yisrael who actually grew up in America, went to high school here, and then went to learn in the Mir Yeshiva. He was the captain of the basketball team at MTA. For anybody who knows who I'm talking about, if you don't, it's okay as well. And he went to learn in the Mir Yeshiva and never came back. He got married in Israel, and at his wedding, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva came, Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel. His yard site was just 2 weeks ago. So Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, at his wedding, took a basketball, went in the middle of the circle, and dribbled the basketball to be Mesameach Chassan V'Kala. And that, to me, is an amazing picture. Here you have the biggest Rosh Hashiva in the world. He has the largest Hashiva. And he's not embarrassed. It's not beneath him. He knows that it will make the Chassan happy to remind him of his past. He knows it will make the Chassan smile if he sees the Rosh Hashiva dribbling a basketball in the middle of the circle. Do it. Why would he be embarrassed? Because when we're involved in a mitzvah, there is no prominence that we give to one individual over another. The Shari Tshuva in Hilchos Lulav writes a story about one yontif in Europe. He says there was a big commotion in the middle of shul. So back then the rabbi didn't face the community when he davened, he faced the wall. So the rabbi is in his own little world davening, and all of a sudden he hears a whole commotion behind him. He turns around and he sees everybody screaming and yelling, everybody's fighting, and he couldn't understand what was happening. He goes to the back to ask them what was happening. And somebody says, well, we're all upset at this member of the community. Why? Because he's a big fear. And he went out before Sukkot to buy himself a lulav and esrog, and nobody else in the community has one. He's the only one. And how dare he walks into shul and doesn't offer his lulav and esrog to the rabbi? What right does he have to walk into the shul and he's the only one who's going to use it? So the rabbi said, why do I deserve his lulav and esrog more than him? What does it matter that I'm the rabbi? We all have equal opportunity and equal obligation to fulfill the mitzvah that God asked us to perform on Sukkot, and therefore he says, there is no difference between me and him. If he went to buy his lulav and esrog, he should have it. And that is the question of the Yerushalmi. V'chiyesh katan v'gadol v'Yisrael. Do we have such a concept? And there are some Jews who are considered more important and others who perhaps are considered less. So one of the Talmidim of the Briska Rav writes in the Sefer Torah Zev that on one occasion the Briska Rav made a bris for a grandchild. And as you can imagine, many of the great luminaries of the generation came to participate in the bris. So they're all sitting there, and the Briska Rav turns to one of the great Talmidei Chachamim who was sitting at the table, and he says, maybe you can honor us with some Divrei Torah. He says, sure. Stands up and he says, you know, it's such a great kavod to be here at the bris of the grandchild of the Briska Rav. And, you know, with all these great Talmidei Chachamim, the Briska Rav said, okay, that's enough, you can sit down. He said, what did I say that was so offensive? He said, why is it more significant that it's my grandchild who's having a bris than anybody else? God asked all of us to perform the mitzvah of bris milah, should a baby boy be born. What is the difference who the parents or the grandparents are? We all have equal opportunity to observe God's mitzvahs, and God loves it equally. And that is what the Yerushalmi teaches us from this Mishnah. One final point, and with this we will close. We find many times throughout the pages of the Gemara that there's a focus that is given on a certain level of uniformity in the Jewish community. And the reason for that is because we don't want people to be embarrassed, we don't want people to be humiliated. So say, for example, it's going to sound strange, but a Shiva house in the days of Chazal was very different than the way a Shiva house is set up today. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, lo ivri yayin ela lenachem aveinu. The reason why we have wine is because It's able to soothe somebody who's in mourning. It's able to pacify them. It's able to calm them down. So when somebody used to sit Shiva, they drank a lot of wine. That's what used to happen. But the Gemara says, dependent on how wealthy you were, what kind of segment of the community you were a part of, that is what kind of wine and what kind of fancy cups we brought over to your home when you were sitting Shiva. So if you were a very wealthy individual, and that is the kind of lifestyle that you live, when you sat Shiva, we brought over very fine wine, and everybody brought beautiful cups, gold and silver, and the Gemara said it got to a point where people didn't want to sit Shiva anymore. It was embarrassing. But I have to put on display how much money I have. Everybody has to know what kind of part of the society I identify with. So say for another example, the Gemara says, it used to be that everybody made their own tachrichim. So Father Mlama, at the end of the day, everybody needs tachrichim at some point. So people used to spend a lot of money to have really fancy tachrichim. And the Gemara says, well, it became very humiliating. Because you would go to one funeral and everybody was crowding around the nifter to see, ooh, let's see, does he have the designer tachrichim? Let's see how much he spent on that. And a simple person who lived in the neighborhood just wasn't able to afford it, was embarrassed. So people stopped having funerals. So the Gemara says, we need to make sure that we have uniformity. You know what? From here on in, says the Gemara, everybody's going to have the same simple tachrichim. This way nobody's going to be uncomfortable, nobody's going to be embarrassed, no one will ever be ashamed again. And from here on in, anybody who's sitting Shiva is going to have the same cups that they're going to use. We're not going to start having differentiation between this one and that one because we have a concern that we don't want to humiliate anybody. And the Gemara has many examples of that, where we find a certain level of uniformity, which makes it strange when you think about the mitzvah of Bikurim. Because there the Mishnah tells us the following. If one was a very wealthy farmer, they would come up to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash, with kalso shel zahav. They would come with baskets that were made out of gold and silver, and they would present that to the Kohen. And if somebody was a poor farmer, they would show up to the Beis HaMikdash with a wicker basket. And that's what they would present. Why aren't we concerned that maybe someone's going to be embarrassed? Why don't we say we should have uniformity here as well? That everybody should bring the same simple wicker basket. This way nobody's going to be looking over the shoulder at somebody else who's standing behind them, in front of them. We want everyone to feel comfortable. How come when it comes to this mitzvah, suddenly we ignore that important ideal? Suddenly it's not a factor at all. And not only that, it becomes more complicated because the Mishnah says that the wealthy farmer who brought the gold and silver basket, the Kohen gave the gold and silver basket back and said, take it home. And the poor farmer who brought the wicker basket gives it to the Kohen, and the Kohen keeps it. So the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Doesn't seem to be fair. I went out of my way to get a wicker basket, and now you're not even going to give it back to me? And the rich man who could afford it, you give him back what he came with? Suggest the Malbim so beautifully. Let's read the Malbim together, because it's such a powerful point. The answer is, he says, writes the Malbim in the 1800s so beautifully. He says, a poor farmer cannot afford to go to the store and buy a basket. So what does he do? He sits there at night every night when he comes home from work, and he spends 5 minutes tonight and 10 minutes the next night creating his own basket with his own hard work. And every night he does this with specific intent because he wants that this should be done in the perfect way. He wants that this should be presented in the best way possible. Says the Malbim, because he exerted so much effort, so much energy to make this basket happen, says the Malbim, don't be embarrassed. There's nothing to be ashamed of. You worked hard to create your own basket that has more value in the eyes of God than anything that a person could ever buy. I once went to somebody's house in our neighborhood, a very beautiful house. And I did find it very strange that when you walk into the living room of this home, they have, you ever seen fake flowers? Sure. They have the fakest looking flowers you've ever seen. Like, nobody would ever mistake them for being real. And I'm wondering, you have the most beautiful home with paintings that are worth more than my entire house costs. And I'm wondering, like, what is with these flowers that couldn't look more fake? Why are they the centerpiece of your living room? But not my position to ask. What do I care? On one occasion, this person explained it to me on their own. They said, you probably have wondered. Actually, I have. So they said, the answer is, this is probably one of the most valuable things we have in our home. I said, why? They told me that they had a babysitter who was a live-in babysitter for years and raised all of their children. Then when their children got of age and they no longer needed a live-in babysitter, after 10 or 15 years, however long it was, they set her up to go to another family because they no longer needed her services. And she was so overwhelmed with gratitude for what this family did for her over all the years, she put together whatever money she had and she bought them a gift the last day she was there. And this is what she was able to afford, and this is what she thought was beautiful. And they said this is one of the most meaningful gifts we've ever done. Because to her, she worked hard to find it. She went out of her way. And that's worth more than any money in the world. Says the Malbim, it's not about money. It's not about how much you spend. It's not about how much you think you're going to impress God. God doesn't care. You know what? You brought a silver basket to the Beit HaMikdash, take it home. We can do without it. We don't need it here. You know what I want to keep? You know what I want to save in the Beit HaMikdash, says the Ribono Shel Olam? The wicker basket that might not look as fancy, but that I know that the farmer spent so many weeks working hard to create that, that has value. That's what the Ribono Shel Olam is interested in. When we invest, when we show him that we care, when we work hard to create something, that is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu likes most. That's what he cherishes most. That's what he values most in our lives. Last January, there was somebody who had sponsored, somebody from our neighborhood had sponsored for 8 Rabbanim to go to Eretz Yisrael for a week to learn together. It was an amazing trip. It was a very powerful trip. And one of the things that I very much wanted to do was, unfortunately, as Rabbanim, one of the questions that you get very often are with regard to issues of fertility. And it's always painful to discuss these questions. And it's very difficult to navigate. So you can read up all the literature and you can know or not know and find out what you're supposed to say about any particular question. But my problem was that I've never actually seen the instruments that we're talking about. I don't fully understand what it is. So I asked our Rosh Weiss if he'd be able to take us on a tour of the Shaare Tzedek IVF lab to actually show us what it is, to explain to us, hands-on, what are we talking about? What are we Paskin and Shilas about? And I thought that that would give a perspective to the Rabbanim that were with us to have a better understanding of the Shilas. So it was an amazing morning. We went to Shaare Tzedek, and we had a tour of the lab, and we also had an opportunity to have a discussion with a woman by the name of Professor Gaona Altaresco. She is a Polish-Jewish woman who is amazing. She was one of the scientists who was involved in discovering the BRCA gene. And she now runs the PGD lab in Shaare Tzedek. So for those who may not be familiar, IVF, I assume everybody knows what it is. PGD is an incredible advancement in science, where it's a mechanism whereby they're able to edit, in simple terms, for myself, it's basically you can do gene editing. So if you have a family that has some kind of genetic disorder, they can now take the genes and they can take certain genes out, put certain things in, move certain things around, and now you can have a child that is born healthy. Professor Altaresco told us the first child that was born in Shaare Tzedek, and they've had hundreds, if not over 1,000, I think, in the last 5 years alone, that were born through PGD. She said the first child that was born was a child who was born to a family where they have 6 children in wheelchairs who have all kinds of machines hooked up to them. And she said that this family, they just attended the boys' bar mitzvah that they had helped create. They said they went to the bar mitzvah, and they said when they walked in, it looked like a hospital. Each child in the family came with all their machines. Each child came with their hospital bed and with their wheelchairs. and with everything that they needed, and this boy walked on his 2 feet needing nothing. He's completely healthy. Amazing miracle of our generation. So she spoke to us about what exactly it is that they do and all the halakhic challenges that go into this kind of conversation and this kind of scientific breakthrough. What was extremely interesting to me was, while we were there, she said, you know, I'm never in the presence of rabbis. Would you mind if I ask a question? So she has a question, and she said, I feel very uncomfortable coming to work every day. Because if God wants a child to be born a certain way, who am I to play God and decide it should be different? That, for me, was a penetrating question. And she said she's very uncomfortable. And although she's responsible for hundreds or thousands of children being born healthy every day, she said, I feel like I'm playing God. So all of us were quiet, and we were lucky to have our lecture wife with us. So it was his job to answer. And he got into a dialogue with her, and he said, well, you can back that up and say that about any medical professional. If God decided that somebody should be sick, who am I to change God's will? Who am I to make them healthier? And after all, the Torah says, "Virapo yirape," that we do have an obligation to help people who we are able to assist. If God decided somebody should be poor, who am I to make sure that now they're going to have a parnasa? Who am I to now hire them? Who am I to go help them out? Maybe God wants them to suffer. So we can't live life like that. And then he turns to all of us and he says, so, a room of 8 rabbis. Anyone has anything to say? So the Gemara says, Hed Yod Kofetz Berosh. It says that sometimes the fool opens his mouth first. And I'm sitting around. Nobody has anything to say. I think everybody was scared. I'm sure everybody had a lot to say. So I broke the ice and I said the following. My father writes in one of his Sfarim, you know, we sit on Seder night, and it's very strange because you talk about all the Esther Machos and you get into all the stories and it's beautiful, but sometimes we have a mistaken impression that all of this happened in one night. And if you read the Midrashim, you'll notice that this was over the span of at least a year. This took a long time for the miracle to unfold. All the Machos and Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamsa, this didn't happen in one evening. This was not a Leil HaSeder. So the Jewish people were enslaved for hundreds of years, and now comes the time when God says, now we're ready for you to go free. And he brings one Macha after the other after the other, and one thing you'll notice is, not once through the entire period of all those Machos going on, in a whole year, not once do they ever bother to sing Shira. Not once do they ever bother to thank God for anything that has happened. Isn't that strange? So you'll say, well, they still had a slave mentality. We're really sure. Are we going to leave? Is this going to last? Okay, maybe I'll buy that. So now we finish Machas Bechoros. Paro sends you out of the land. Now, the Jews did not know that there was going to be a miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf. Nobody knew that was coming. They assumed, we're gone. We're out of the land. Everything's fine. Smooth sailing from here. Now they come and they encounter a new problem. God all of a sudden does this unbelievable miracle, splits the sea, and all of them are experiencing this unbelievable revelation that they've never had before. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, hey, I have an idea. Az Yashu Moshe Vanisha, maybe it would be appropriate to thank God. Maybe it would be the nice thing to do. And you ask yourself, now you're telling us to do that? Where have you been? This has been going on for a year. God has wowed us with his miracle. Where have you been, Moshe Rabbeinu? Now is the first time that it dawns on anybody to sing Shira? What was unique about that moment of Kriyas Yamsuf over anything else that had happened leading up to that point? Rav Soloveitchik explained the reason why is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said throughout the period of the Machos, we were passive bystanders. Everything was done by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, the Kavod of HaAtzmo. And although it's amazing, and although it's wonderful to be a part of that, there is nothing as meaningful in life as when the Ribono Shel Olam turns to us and he says, now it's your turn to write the next chapter of your own history. Now it's your turn to invest in yourself, to work hard, and make the next part of this miracle a reality. God turns to Moshe Rabbeinu when he's standing by the Yamsuf and he says, what are you looking at me? God, bear over the Yisrael that you sow. Now I'm handing it over to you. Now I'm allowing you to create the next chapter of your own miracle. And the Jewish people say, we've never felt this good. of Yasher Moshe Vinay Yisrael. There is nothing more satisfying in life, more gratifying in life than when I am given the opportunity to work hard to create something. That is the greatest gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can give any of us. That is why the Kohen keeps that basket. That is why this woman should not feel uncomfortable doing God's work when God hands it over to the doctor. When God says, here, I've brought you until this point and now I'm handing it over to humanity to take over. That is the greatest gift a human being can ever have. That is the most satisfying feeling in the world that God wants us to partner with him and work hard to create his miracle. And there's nothing in the world that should make us more excited than that. That is the gift of life. Sir Soloveitchik has in one of his English books, the Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin that Hillel was once sitting with a number of his friends, and he turns to one of them and he says, we're finished in 2 minutes. He turns to one of them and he says, Ein Mashiach li Yisrael. Ein Mashiach li Yisrael. What does that mean? There's not going to be a Messiah for the Jewish people? Really? He doesn't believe in Mashiach? So his friend turns back to him and he says, Shari le Mari le Hillel. Rav Yosef, I believe the Gemara says, was the friend, and he says, I hope God could find a place in his heart to forgive Hillel for this horrible statement. How can he say such a thing? Ein Mashiach li Yisrael, that's an awful statement to say. Does he not believe in the coming of Mashiach? So Rashi there says, of course Hillel didn't mean that. No religious Jew would say that we don't believe in Mashiach. We all believe in Mashiach. So what did Hillel mean? Rashi says he meant that when it comes to the end of days, we don't want a human intervention. We want God, the Chavod of Asmo, to come and save us. We don't want a Mashiach li Yisrael. We want God to show us his incredible miracles. B'yach hazak of Israel and Tuya, like he did. By all the makos, that's what we want. Sir of Soloveitchik asked, if that's all Hillel said, why were his friends so offended? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that an amazing statement to say that, God, I want to experience you. I want to see you perform the miracles. Explainer of Soloveitchik. As unacceptable as it is for a person to say, Ein Mashiach li Yisrael in the literal sense, as unacceptable as it is for someone to believe that there will not be the coming of Mashiach, it is equally unacceptable, he says, for a person to say that I won't have a part in it. God wants all of us to invest in ourselves, and that is the only way that Mashiach will come. That is the only way that redemption comes in this world, is when human beings are willing to work hard to create their own redemption. It's when human beings are willing to invest in themselves and understand that God has given you the opportunity to create something special and to make something happen. And says of Soloveitchik, if anyone ever dare get up and say, I want God to do it himself and we won't have a part of it, that is an unacceptable statement. I know I said I'm finishing. I can't finish without saying this. Rav Chaim Volozhiner writes, in the very end of Maseches Sota, the Gemara says, many terrible things are going to happen in the end of days, and the economy is going to be haywire, and there's going to be so much promiscuity, there's going to be horrible things going on all over the world. And at that point, we're going to throw up our hands and say, God, you got to take care of this. So we all understand that Mishnah, but says Rav Chaim Volozhiner, you're misunderstanding the Mishnah. The Mishnah really means that one of the aspects of klala, one of the curses is going to be, yes, the economy is going to be haywire and people are going to be doing terrible things. And the worst part of it all is people are going to say, Eilanu al mili yishayin ela al avinu shebashamayim. People are going to throw up their hands and say, God, there's nothing more that I can do in the world. The world is so horrible, now it's your problem. When human beings step back and say, there's nothing I can invest, there's nothing I can do to make the world a better place, that is the worst curse of them all. There's nothing that can be worse than that. Says of Chaim Volozhiner, that's what the Mishnah means. And that's perhaps something we can take away from this Mishnah. When we think about what Thanksgiving means to a Jew, when we bring our Bikurim, and what are the messages, the subliminal messages behind the offering of the Bikurim and the procedure and the process of all that goes into it, we walk away with that message that don't forget. The harder a person works, the more ordinary they are, the simpler the Jew. It's not about the money that we have. It's not about the prominence that we hold in our community. It's not about how other people look about us. It's about how much God cares for the investment that we show, the amount of interest that we have in the performance of his mitzvot and in partnering with him to make our world a better place than it's able to be. I wish all of you a wonderful day. Thank you once again for coming. And enjoy your day off. Happy New Year. Okay.